Homage to the Buddha. But there's two meanings to the word Buddha. The Buddha has sort of two levels. Of course, one, the common level is the awakened one, the historical Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha who attained supreme enlightenment, Sammasambuddha, who taught the Dhamma for 45 years, established the order of the Sangha, and then passed away in the Parinibbana. But as most of you know, the Buddha's famous saying that one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha, and one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. So in that sense, the Buddha is the Dhamma. So, and especially the Dhamma of no self, the Dhamma of anatta, or basically experiencing the unconditioned Dhamma, the Nirvana Dhatu. That's, the essence of all existence, the unconditioned state. And that's within each person also. That's why we can all become Buddhists, because we all have that intrinsic or essential deathless element, which is the ultimate reality. So when you're chanting, at least when I chant Namo Buddhaya, or when you're even when you're looking at a Buddha image, apart from identifying it maybe as the historical Buddha, that you see it as a reflection of your own mind. You see it as a reflection, or the vibration of Buddhaya is that vibration of anatta, or the vibration of emptiness, the vibration of the unborn reality. And so when chanting that homage to the Buddha, it's that it's awakening that vibration of the unborn that's the underlying ground of even our consciousness, and the unborn vibration, the vibration of pure awareness, and that makes a kind of connection. And so it helps to calm the mind, relax the mind into the present moment. And because the word Buddha, goes back in the collective psyche, in the collective unconscious for, millions of years, or hundreds and thousands of eons and kalpas of time. The word Buddha has been used. And so that sort of vibration, we all understand that vibration deep down inside. So when we hear that, it's like some connection is made that, you know, starts kind of pulling us or leading us unconsciously toward that truth, to learn more how we can relate, to discover that truth that's within us. And for those who read my autobiography, maybe I've told this story before sometimes when I've come here about my own experience. He mentioned it yesterday when I bought this Buddha statue in Mexico. I didn't even know what it was, you know. When I was sitting on my TV and I was looking at it, although I hung my hat on it, which wasn't so good. But anyway, even that it caused me to look at it. And, you know, it was probably, you know, awakening something deeper inside that I didn't know at the time. So that's how this, this connection and the words of the Dhamma and, you know, the Buddha and images, they're kind of archetypes of the reality that's already within us, and that we yearn to kind of come back home, as it were, you know, to the truth, and to, you know, because our inner wisdom knows that this world and conditioned world is just a, you know, the conditioned world. You know, it's not the real, you know, life. It's just one of dukkha, but, you know, we can't do much about it, the ordinary person. So when we get our first glimpse of the truth, it's like a connection is made from, the deeper connection is made, and that is what gradually leads us on. And of course, that's the idea of the sotapanna. Once one gets a really glimpse of the truth, there's no way that their mind can go backwards, and it keeps on going. And it's because we have that buddhaya within us, we have that that element of, you know, that intrinsic pure awareness that's you know, beyond birth and death, the deathless element within us. Anyway, because we just mentioned the deathless element, but let us come back to death for a while. the nitty gritty of birth and death, the nuts and bolts of birth and death. And the, you know, the conditioned mind. And this morning we were doing the meditation on feeling the impermanence of the body. And, you know, when you have the feeling of the, you know, everything is changing every moment, and you tune into impermanence, you see that each moment is constantly changing. You know, each of those moments actually is a birth and a death. But, you know, there's two levels of the meaning of rebirth. And one is the external rebirth, that, you know, the common one that people know about, or at least the Buddhists know about, or Hindus, about this, you know, from the mind going from lifetime to lifetime, experiencing different lokas according to its karma. And so we're born, this body has a certain lifespan, and then it dies. We get a new body, and that goes on and on and on until ad infinitum, until, or ad nauseum is probably a better word, until we get sick of it, until one attains liberation. But the same process is going on moment to moment on what is called the microscopic level. So the external rebirth I dub as called a macrocosmic rebirth. It means rebirth in the larger cosmos. And then the microcosmic rebirth, I mean the rebirth that's happening at the atomic level, even the atoms that are being born and dying, the molecules and cells that are being born every second, and as well as the consciousness that's being born and reborn, or being born and dying moment by moment. And, you know, impermanence is the underlying reality of all conditioned phenomena. And, you know, everything that is born is subject to death. But, you know, most human beings, they have a fear of death. And most fears that people have, fear of losing something, fear of getting old, or fear of the dark, or fear of... this is all comes back to the fear of death. Because over the infinite number of past lifetimes, we've all experienced the most horrible kinds of death, as being slaughtered and killed, as being animals or human beings, undergoing the sufferings of the hells, and then even after experiencing bliss in the heaven worlds, plunging down into the hells from there and undergoing many types of suffering. So all these kind of memories are there in our mind. And it's said that every single thing we've ever experienced, even in all of our lifetimes, is somehow in the the unconscious. And that's why the Buddha, of course, could, with his psychic power, go back methodically, lifetime to lifetime, and remember hundreds and thousands of eons and involutions and evolutions of the world cycles in all of its details. And that's why he said, enough is enough. You know, it's time to stop. It's time to get off the wheel. That's when he sought out the path of enlightenment to attain real, the ultimate liberation. But it's not just attaining liberation from samsara in terms of rebirth from lifetime to lifetime, but even in this lifetime itself, you can attain a liberation from the microcosmic rebirth as well. This one's arhants, the Buddha attained parinibbana, or not parinibbana, but became arahant. Then basically they got off the wheel of rebirth even at that time. So the Buddha lived for 45 years, walking thousands of miles through India, giving 84,000 Dhamma discourses. But he was free from the wheel of birth and death even while living. So that's an incentive for us to something to work for. But so the idea about death, people have the fear of death because basically they don't understand it, or they've lived an unskillful life and they're afraid about the consequences of what may happen after death. And even Christians have that kind of thing. If they lived unskillfully, they think God is going to send them to hell or something. So it's the same sort of the principle kind of working. But death is, from the Dhamma point of view, is nothing to be feared about. That, the process of evolution, and our minds and bodies are going through the process of evolution for hundreds and thousands of lifetimes, millions of billions of years. And it's a natural process, and anything that is born is subject to death. And actually, death is the only thing that's certain in life. Life isn't certain. Because for some reason or other, if this breath stops for more than a few minutes, or the heart stops beating for more than a few minutes. Forget that guy who's 45 minutes, okay? That's not average, but you know, then this body would die. So life is not certain because, you know, even sometimes babies die in the womb. When they come out, 1 minute after coming out, they die. 2 minutes after coming out, they die. In every increment of minutes and seconds and hours and days and weeks, up to 100 or more years, people are dying at every stage of that, in every conceivable possible way, from accidents, murder, just the natural expenditure of the lifespan and so on. According to karma, the people have died. And we don't know when death will occur. That's the great hidden unknown. But it will occur. And it's something that shouldn't be afraid about. Why do people are afraid of death? Of course, why are they're afraid of getting old and sick? Because they don't want to experience that pain of getting old and feeble and sick, and their relatives having to feed them with a spoon, push them around in a wheelchair, and you know, all these sort of imagined things. People have a big fear about that and anxiety. Because really they're identifying with themselves as this body. They're identifying, you know, the body as their self, or the pain and suffering that's going to come when they get older. But, you know, death happens to everybody. In fact, you know, there's 6 billion people on this planet. That's what the statistics say, right? And let's say the average lifespan was 80 years. So in 80 years, 6 billion people would have been, died. 6 billion people. That's a lot. If you took all those bones of all those people and piled them up, now that's why they're going to discover another planet to store the bones. Because there wouldn't even be enough room on this planet to store all the bones of 6 billion people who died. That's why they have to cremate the bodies to become powder and then... So, you know, and every day, if you break down those statistics, I think it comes out to about every day 250,000 people around the. I don't know if it's exactly, I didn't memorize it, but anyway, it's a big number. That every day, or at least every week, you know, 250,000 people die. You can crunch the numbers to find out how many that is, but it comes down to, you know, every minute, you know, 20,000 people are, you know, falling like flies all over the globe and earth. Even if you boil it down to a minute, it would be probably, you know, 1,000 or more. So people are just dropping like flies all over. And young people, not only old people, young people, as I just mentioned. And so, by contemplating, we said, you got up this morning, you were lucky. You were a survivor. You got one more day. But we can't take that for granted. Because you all know from the news that even healthy, strong people drop dead from any number of unknown karmic, genetic problems they might have had, or just because of other karmic situations, you know, a whole family can get wiped out in a car accident. You know, you all know that. But we tend to want to dismiss it, or the average person does. They don't like to hear those type of details. And that's why whenever you hear about some tragedy, you know, it's you hear about it and you kind of say, well, you know that's too bad, but you know, it wasn't me. Or, you know, it's happening on the other side of the world. Of course, for you all, if it happens in Sri Lanka, that affects you more closely. But for others, it's just, you know, it's happening out there. And they tend to dismiss it and think that they're going to live for another days or weeks or months or years. And that causes heedlessness. Because it, gives rise to then more attachments and clinging to, I have 10 more years to enjoy in the world and accumulate and do all these things. You know, people have a bucket list now, right? There was a movie called The Bucket List. How many of you saw that? It's about two American men. You know, they're already like 65 years old, they had some terminal diseases, and they said, oh, let's do everything we can before we die. You know, they wanted to climb Mount Everest, you know, they wanted to do every possible thing before they died. But meditation wasn't one of them. So the Buddha recommended the contemplation of death. That's one of actually what is called the four protections. You know, the chatu raksha. Yeah, the four protections. The person might think, what? Contemplating death? That's a protection. You know, most people would think that that's a curse. We can see how metta is a protection, you know. And But the point behind death, the contemplation of death, is not that we want to die, no. We need to live for as long as it takes to at least attain sotapanna. That would be the ideal, of course, the purpose of the life. But to contemplate death is to instigate the sense of urgency. That if you die with the mind still with the kilesas, the defilements, with lobha, dvesha, and moha, then you know the rest, right? You know that it's going to be a painful situation. So that the sense of urgency not to delay the meditation practice, but to begin practicing in a kind of a sincere way to prepare the mind for the death. So really our life, and in our practice of Dhamma, we're preparing ourselves for death. It's kind of an insurance policy. Called the samsara insurance. That means we're creating the kusala kamma for insurance that when we die, our mind will be better prepared to attain at least a better rebirth, or even to attain stages of enlightenment. So that's a kind of insurance. Of course, the only real insurance is attaining so-on, or, you know, entering the stream. That's insurance for 7 more rebirths. And then the once returning is insurance for only 1 more birth, and so on. But, so to instill the sense of urgency, knowing that, you know, even though we've survived and we have good health now, that could change. And you can remember all of your friends, all of your relatives, or people that you read about in the newspapers or heard about on the news, the way that, you know, infinite numbers of people have died from so many surprise causes and conditions. And there's no way to control that. The time of death, the place of death, how we're going to die, that's all unknown. Those are the great unknowns. The fact that we will die, but the time is not certain, the place is not certain, and the means is not certain. And it could come at any unexpected time. And then will the mind be ready? As I mentioned earlier in the morning meditation, you know, do you have any unfinished business? What is unfinished business in the mind? Whether it's having any strong attachments, magiputa, magidua, or whatever, you know, or any fear, worry, anxiety, any strong, you know, any anger, and basically, you know, lobha, dvesha, moha, ignorance, greed, and hatred. But all the emotions, like, you know, and not for having forgiven others, you know, holding people out of your heart, not forgiving others, holding grudges and ill will. This is one of the very strongest kind of poisons in the mind. And so if we die with any of those, either, you know, aversions, ill will, anger toward people, or any strong attachment to people or places in your house, that's why people come back as ghosts. They have strong attachment to their house or other material possessions, and they want to be near it. So they're born near their house, but they're a ghost and they can't enjoy the house, and they only suffer. Or with the ill will and resentment, you've all heard the Jataka stories and the stories about the two wives that went around many, many lifetimes killing each other's babies and so on as revenge for the other one doing it in the previous life and holding on to these grudges and ill will. That's the surest sign that you'll be reborn. It's payback, or it's the, you know, the unfinished business. That person did this to me. And so the mind will be attracted to come back to finish that business, and more suffering. So anyway, I'm just saying that. So that's the unfinished business. So we should always, you know, ask ourselves, you know, am I prepared to die? What is the unfinished business? What are you dreaming about at night? What's coming up in your mind in meditation that you can't let go of? See, that's the training in meditation. Is that when you meditate, sure, you can see so many thoughts going by. The idea is not to stop the thoughts, but to watch the whole myriad of thoughts going through the unconscious, but not clinging to any of them. Not even the picture of your mother, or the picture of some monster, or, you know, vision of blood, or anything. Not clinging to any of them. And so, you know, that's the training. So when it comes up at the time of death, the mind won't cling to any of those. Because I think you all know the death process. When you die, the strongest image that comes up in your mind at the time of death, the mind is going to grasp after that strong image from our past karma or present habits. And that will be called the gati nimitta, the sign of destiny, which the mind will grab that. And that is what draws it to a similar type of loka or vibration, which will then allow it to, you know, work out its karma in connection with that. And another aspect about the death. You know, people are always worrying about what is the cause of death, right? They're so worried. You know, what's the cause of death? What's the cause of this? Why is this happening to me? And even at the time of an autopsy, right? If somebody dies, you have to get the coroner out of bed at 2 o'clock in the morning and drag him down to the hospital to determine, was this a brain aneurysm, or was this a heart aneurysm, or, you know, what was this that caused the death? People are so obsessed, especially doctors, with trying to find the exact cause of death. And even poor doctors, you know, they're struggling to save the life. Even somebody who's totally broken, beyond saving, they think it's their duty to save them. If the person dies on the operating table, they feel like they failed. I'm a failure. I couldn't save the life. Or their families will sue them for, producing some miraculous powers that can save the life. Of course, you know, there are mistakes made, and some doctors might, due to negligence, cause the death. But, that's probably not the majority of cases. But the fact is that death happens. And so I don't know if I've told this story before, but I was in Brazil a couple of years ago, and I went to an autopsy because there was a Brazilian person who was a pathologist and was the head of the autopsies department in a big hospital in Sao Paulo. Sao Paulo has about 20 million people, and you know, so many thousands are dying every day. So she took me down there because I never saw an autopsy before, and I wanted to see what my reaction would be to seeing somebody's skull cut off with a saw and take the brains out. And I actually held a brain in my hand and was looking at it and was contemplating it. You know, just, you know, 10 hours before, you know, this thing was shooting out sparks of electricity and everything else, and a live human being, you know, and now it's sitting there looking at it. But then I asked the doctor, you know, you have to write on the death certificate the cause of death. Do you always find the cause of death? Sometimes she said, well, sometimes it's difficult to know exactly what the cause of death was. So I told her, you write birth. See, birth is the death of cause of death. We shouldn't be worrying about how we die, because birth is the cause of death. And, you know, people are talking about birth control these days. You know, over the last 20, 30 years, birth control, right? People are trying to do birth control. But Buddhists, as a Buddhist, we try to do rebirth control. By attaining enlightenment, then we're controlling the rebirth. We're controlling the birth. So that's the real birth control, is attaining enlightenment. So, but how do we really go about that? And I wanted to focus on some aspects of the Paticca Samuppada. I think most of you Sri Lankans, you know what the Paticca Samuppada is, right? The 12 links of dependent origination. You know, avidya, patya, sankara, and going through all those 12 links. And, you know, that describes, of course, the rebirth from lifetime to lifetime. But more importantly, for our practice of meditation, it also describes the moment-to-moment rebirth process. And even every moment of consciousness, the whole 12 links have made a cycle. But especially five of them are the most important. And the five of them are the ones that we can actually try to manage and eventually kind of control through the practice of the meditation, especially of the you know, the mindfulness meditation. So we have ignorance and the karmic formations. This was, you know, from a past life. This is what has got us born in this life, was whatever ignorance and sankaras in the previous life caused the consciousness to arise in this present life. And so we all have the consciousness actually produces the mind and body. Even consciousness produces matter, influences the development of matter, of the body. So we have the mind and body, and we have the six senses. And so this much has been created in the womb of the baby, you see. Rebirth linking consciousness helped to create the mind and body, nama rupa, that means a little fetus in the beginning of the brain and the consciousness, the perception. And then the six senses got developed, and then it was, you know, shoved outside. Then boom, contact. I think I already mentioned that yesterday or the day before. And then because of the contact, there's these feelings. So far, all that has been the product of the past karma. We have no control over that. And it's basically a given. So right now, your whole life, or whatever age you're at, you've had as a constant, this name and form, six senses, contact and feelings, have been arising, and basically you can't do anything about it. There's nothing you can do about it. You're basically stuck with it. It's the result of past karma. But the next factors are things that we can begin to manage and control. And the whole practice of Dhamma is basically for that. And so that is, okay, we have feelings. We can't stop the feelings. The painful, pleasant, neutral feelings, they're going to arise. But dependent on feeling arises craving. Even craving, we can't really control very easily. And I'll explain why in a few moments. Dependent on, and craving basically is the initial sort of desire for something. You know, like let's say you have a pain in the knee, and because there's two types of craving: positive craving with desire for something, and negative craving means the desire to get away from that, craving to be rid from the pain. So they're both types of craving. So, you know, if you're meditating, all of a sudden you feel a pain somewhere, that initial kind of reaction or shrinking away is the initial sort of, you know, desire or aversion to get away from it. Now, if we have mindfulness, and we say, oh, it's no big deal, it's just a small, and you don't pay attention to it, you continue your meditation, then basically that pain doesn't cause you any suffering, really. But if you don't have control over your mind, then you start, oh, it's a pain in my knee. Oh, what's happening? Oh, this and that's going to happen. And you start thinking about it. You start having fear about this pain. That is the grasping. So craving leads to grasping. And grasping is simply the intensified craving. And it's the grasping actually that triggers off all of our various thoughts. See, now you're grasping after this. You don't need to be looking over there, really. You're getting distracted. So practice the Dhamma right now. This is the practice of Dhamma. It's not some fairy tale. You know, don't get attracted to something that doesn't bother you. Keep your mind concentrated. That's why you can't concentrate. Anything that happens, you want to look at this and look at this and look at this. I guess it's a boring lecture. Go ahead and look. Okay. So dependent on craving arises the grasping. And this is what triggers off our emotions like fear, worry, and jealousy, envy, sadness, happiness, the whole gamut of emotions. And then you're plotting, how am I going to capture this object of my desire? Or how am I going to push away this object of my aversion? It's the planning and scheming and conniving and making deals and wheeling and dealing in order to get the object of one's craving or desire. So all of that's included in grasping. So grasping is much, much stronger than the initial craving. And once the grasping has arisen, it's much more difficult to get it out of the mind. So with the initial craving, you know, if we have good mindfulness, and again, as I mentioned with that, or any other desire, let's say a thought, or a desire to have an ice cream or something, if we just note it as it's initially coming up in the mind and just be, desire. If our mindfulness is strong enough, that desire will just drop out of the mind. And it won't go anywhere. But only when you start grasping the idea of an ice cream, it's very hot, yeah, ice cream would be nice, and this and that. Start, you know, that's the grasping. And then so craving itself is really not a big deal. Because it can be easily dropped away through developing a good level of mindfulness, and of course practicing sort of restraint and so on. But then this grasping, you know, it builds up to a climax, and then a moment comes where you have to decide. Decision. You know, you planned and schemed and thought about how you're going to get or get away from something. Then there's a decision of actually doing it. And then you make a decision and you do it or you don't do it. But that doing is the bhava, is the karma. So dependent on grasping arises becoming. They call it becoming because the habit has become stronger. Every time you repeat something, it strengthens the neuronal pathways in the brain and nervous system that it will repeat itself or want to repeat itself again the next time. So every time we exercise it with deliberate desire, you know, karmic action, karma means the intention, the intentional volition. And so we strengthen the karma. The karma becomes stronger. And also the sense of I becomes stronger. Because I won. I got it. I got the object of my desire. Or I got away from the object of my pain. So the sense of I is re-strengthened in the consciousness. And that gives rise to but. So dependent on bhava arises birth. And this birth doesn't mean the rebirth of the baby in the womb. This means the I will be born again in the next moment. Because you strengthen it. You strengthen it through bhava. And so in the next moment with consciousness, the sense of I comes up again. That's the rebirth. It's the rebirth of the I consciousness. Along with the new consciousness, the I again appears. That's the deeper meaning of rebirth. We call the microcosmic rebirth. In the Paticca Samuppada, it makes a complete cycle like that, even in a, you know, just a flash. And then because the I exists, that I is going to suffer there and then as well, or experience the happiness of done some good deed, like making merit. So that whole process, the craving, grasping, becoming, and birth, and then the suffering, those five, those are what are continually arising moment by moment. Again, the mind, body, senses, contact, feeling, these are already a given that are always there. You can't do anything about. But with the proper cultivation of mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, of course, practice of Dhamma, like precepts and the other aspects of the Eightfold Path, one can start reducing the power of that process, especially of grasping. Now, even craving, you can't really prevent craving until you're an anagami. You know, once returner weakens craving to a great extent, but only in an anagami, a never returner, is craving, that means kamaraga, ruparaga, and patiga, that means the craving and aversion for the material world, gets totally gone. Only with an anagami. So you can see, craving is not easy to get rid of. So don't worry about it right away. But Buddhists are always saying, oh, get rid of craving, get rid of craving. You're not going to be able to get rid of craving. Craving is a very powerful energy that as long as you have desire and as long as you have the ego, the sense of self, you can't overcome desire. Especially if you have the sense of self, believe in the sense of self and I, it's impossible to overcome desire. Because the ego and desire are like two sides of a coin. You can't have one without the other. The ego exists for desire. Desire is the food for the ego. So if you believe in it, if you have sakkaya ditti, and you believe in the sense of I, then you can't overcome desire, because it's like committing suicide. Trying to get rid of your desires is like committing suicide for the ego. So as long as you believe in the ego, you won't be able to overcome desire. And you can't force desire to go away. But you can understand desire. So you can't get rid of desire, you can understand desire. And in the understanding of desire, the desire ceases. When you understand how desire and the ego are interconnected, interwoven, and how that gives rise to the suffering, then the desire will start ceasing by itself. And you don't have to get rid of the desire. That's the power of wisdom. That's why wisdom is the crowning jewel of the practice of meditation. So therefore, don't be too concerned with giving up your cravings right now. Work on grasping. Grasping is what we can sort of manage and control. Because craving just happens in a brief second, a split second. But then grasping takes over. So it's the grasping that we want to work on. That's all the thoughts and continued thoughts and exercise of that. And so the only way we work on grasping is normally we see the pleasant effects of the grasping. We're clinging to the outer details of the objects that we're attached to. So naturally that feeds the grasping. And so that's why the Tilakana, the three characteristics, contemplating everything as anicca, dukkha, anatta, or to see the impure aspects or the danger in having attachments. What is attachments lead to? They lead to breaking all the precepts and lead to being reborn as ghosts and in the hills and suffering. And so that's sort of a stimulus to sort of restrain oneself from allowing the mind to just indulge in all these types of fantasies and developing the grasping. Because the grasping, of course, leads to the becoming. So this is where the important connection between sila is. You practice sila in order to weaken and prevent the becoming. That means the negative karmic actions. Because, you can have a thought. Let's see, a mosquito is biting you. And you see that urge, okay, mosquito landing on you is painful feeling. And you see the initial desire to get away. And if you're a good meditator and or have good insight, you can just say, well, mosquito is kamak. Of course, if you're in Sri Lanka, then you're going to, oh, dengue, malaria, malaria. And fear will arise. But here in Canada, you don't have to worry about that. But anyway, if you can't resist that initial urge, then you see the mind thinking about it. And then, if you're unmindful, then the hand slips up, right? The hand slips up, you're just about ready to smash the mosquito, and then you remember, ah, panatit pata vedamani. So, grasping, grasping is what pushed the hand up, right? But because you had the precept, in the last minute you remembered that, and that saved you from becoming. That means from creating the karmic action of killing, right? So the precept is what blocks becoming. So that's why we have the precepts to block the becoming of telling lies, malicious speech, all the precepts. Or even monks and other people, they have even many more precepts that makes them be that much more mindful. So the practice of the precept stops the becoming. And the practice of samadhi, works on the grasping. And the panya works on the craving. That means when you attain the sotapanna, or once returning and never returning, that's the panya that weakens and destroys the fetters, not concentration. Anyway, I'll probably talk more about that in tomorrow's talk, that aspect of the practice. But, it's coming back to this sequence of craving, grasping, becoming, and the birth, to see how it's the ego that is reborn each time you make a conscious action. The sense of I is strengthened. And we go on strengthening the sense of I, because we're always saying, I want this, I'm doing this, I. Or me, or mine. So the Buddhist trinity is I, me, and mine, or the trinity of suffering is I, me, and mine. It's behind every single thing that we do. There's either the sense of I am doing it, or giving it to me, or this is mine. And just check it out next time, in your own mind. You see, there's always there. That is Sakkaya Ditti. You can see Sakkaya Ditti, actually see it. It's not just some word in a book. You actually see its strength. It's a belief in the self. Of course, even though you might intellectually know that it's an illusion by reading the Dhamma, But still, the sense of I is can still be there. That's why even with a sotapanna overcomes the sense, breaks the sakkaya ditti, but he still has mana. Mana means that residual sense of I that arises with the consciousness. Even though intellectually he knows it's an illusion, nevertheless it still is there in the mind, and he has to continue to be mindful not to allow that sense of self to create some negative karma. Of course, for a sotapanna, it wouldn't be that strong that he commits a negative karma to cause rebirth in the lower realm. I'm assuming you know this basic dhamma, most of you. So anyway, in your meditation practice, because that's the real creative process. That's the process of continued living, is this process of craving, grasping, becoming, and birth and suffering. And so it can be a topic and an object, or it is the topic and object of Vipassana meditation. Observing, the five aggregates or the six senses and how they're working, you can see that the first thing is that the painful feeling arises. You can't do anything about it, but at least you can recognize it. Ah, that's painful feeling. Or that's pleasant feeling. And then immediately you see the craving or aversion arise. Or sometime you might see the aversion arise first and only identify it later as a painful feeling. That's because your awareness is slow. But and again, if you have mindfulness, you can leave it at that. And by just observing, being aware of pain, or aversion. And again, this is sort of the trick. This is the hidden secret. The secret to meditation is that normally, we think it's the object that we want. When we have a pain, or let's say we're angry, and we're focusing on the object of our anger, that person insulted me. Or we're looking at the object of our desire, that object. And as long as we're looking at the object, the desire will keep on generating in the mind. So in Chittanupassana, we focus on the mental state itself, like the anger itself. Instead of looking at the object of the anger, we're just looking at anger itself. Anger. And you feel what the anger is doing inside the body. You don't think about the person that's causing your anger. You look at the anger itself as sensation. And feel what it's doing in the body, and just, this is anger, yes. My jaw is crunching, my fists are tightening up, sweat coming out, the body is trembling. And you just look at the emotion itself. And when you're looking at the emotion, you're no longer paying attention to the object, so the object will disappear. When the object disappears, the emotion disappears. And that's how you can become free from it. You have to disassociate the emotion with the object that caused the emotion. By looking directly at the mental state itself. And this is the teaching of Chittanupassana in Satipatthana Sutta. When the mind has anger, you just recognize it. Anger is in the mind. You don't recognize what caused the anger. Of course you can, that's another part of it, but the trick is when you're observing just the anger itself, it's no longer connected with an object. It's the object that produces the anger, so the anger disappears too. And it's very interesting, you can observe that in your meditation if you have good insight, if you have good mindfulness. And this is really studying the mind. And this is really understanding, you know, the Buddha, they call him the Supreme Buddha, you know, Anuttaro, Samyaksambuddha. You know, how could anybody discover this? Even today's nuclear scientists can't do that. They don't know anything about the mind. I mean, they know something about the mind now, but not like that. You know, the Buddha was a super scientist. You know, the whole Satipatthana Sutra is such a marvelous, explanation of the whole science of body and mind. How the world comes to be, how it dissolves from moment to moment. If we know how to cultivate the wisdom. And it can be done. But one has to know the proper steps, and of course one has to then make the effort to do it. But that effort is really the only type of noble effort. Because again, we're talking about the idea of the death and so on. It's at the time of death, if you don't know how to do this, then you're doomed. That means if you don't know how to, let go of the grasping and apply this insight. That's how so many arhats, they attained arhatship right before the time of death. Because, that sense of death urgency was such that they applied their whole mind, and within just a few split seconds could cut that grasping and the bhava and free the mind, attain arhatship. Like, I think you all heard the famous story of, I think his name was Moggallapurta Tissa, Anuradhapura. There's a famous story in the suttas. The monk was walking down. He had been practicing the Subha Bhavana, contemplating bones. Seeing everything as just bones. So he had developed that to a good degree. So one day he was walking down on Pindapata, down from the hill into the village, and a lady from the village came running out with her hair all wet, and she was crying, and the monk was keeping his eyes down, and he heard some noise, just in front, so he kind of looked up and saw this, and at that time the lady smiled and her big white teeth, and the monk, that white teeth hit his perception, and he just saw bones, filled up his whole field of perception. And there and then, he paused and stopped and built up reflexive insight and attained arhatship within the space of just a few seconds. And then the lady ran off. He kept on walking, lifting, swinging, placing, lifting, swinging, placing. And then the husband ran out a few minutes later and stopped the monk. And, "Monsieur, did you see my wife run by?" He said, "I don't know if it was man, woman, or beast. Some bones went by." So that's the way that we, that's applied, what is called applied, logic or applied meditation. Applying it when it counts the most. And actually, I had to do that when I was a young monk at Unawatuna. Because I think some of you know that I lived at Unawatuna and the Valley Deva, on the beach, before it became famous as a tourist spot. And so I was, lived there for some years. And then it got known as a tourist spot. And Western tourists used to come there and want to, sit on the beach half naked. So I had to walk down from the hill and across the beach in order to go to my alms round. And so I applied this type of meditation and didn't allow my mind to look at the outer details and was just seeing them as skeletons. And it worked. It was very helpful to not getting distracted and Eventually I did leave, though it was getting too much crowded and popular, but so, you know, these kind of practices do work. But this is really the applied meditation. And so these various types of meditation the Buddha gave us, there's reality behind it. But they're all about helping to give us the skills which we can cut through the mara, you know, cut through the clinging to the external marks of beauty and sort of seeing underneath the skin. And that's the aspect of wisdom, you know, that's wisdom. That's where wisdom plays its important part and aids, is the crowning jewel of mindfulness and concentration. Mindfulness and concentration is just sort of preparing the ground and bringing the objects into focus, but it's the wisdom that, you know, dissects them into anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So anyway, that's, you know, that's how we have to, you know, and that's, again, that's the next step. People are always asking, what's the next step in meditation? Watching the breath, watching the breath. What's the next step? Oh, sensations. Okay, I've been watching sensations for many months or years, you know. Sensations, sensations. What's the next step? Read the sutta! So anyway, just for a moment now to let that excitement kind of calm down. Just take a couple of deep, slow breaths. Try to let any excitement of that kind of calm back down. Just feel the body, the breathing body. Just take a deep breath, hold the breath in a few seconds.